the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
We live in a very complex society today, one that is very litigious. You have to protect your assets from creditors, but also from lawsuits, and not to mention the fact from taxes. Joining me on the program is Elizabeth Morgan. She's a specialist in complex tax planning vehicles. And Elizabeth, I want to talk today about limited partnerships and limited liability companies. Now, I know with the passage of the tax law, the exemption is $11,180,000. At one time, limited partnerships were used to sort of get a discount on assets and save on taxes. Does that still apply today with the exemption as high as it is?
Well, I guess, Jim, it depends on the value of your assets. So certainly the increased lifetime exclusion makes estate planning a whole lot simpler because it really only applies to a very small population. But limited partnerships are still being used significantly, especially on, you know, sales transactions to freeze value and to reduce value for asset protection. I mean, excuse me, for estate planning for those who are in that very top tier. I think that really now the use of these entities is most important from an asset protection standpoint rather than an estate planning standpoint. Now, that being said, if you look back at our history with our this concept of a lifetime exclusion, it's always possible that that exclusion amount could drop. So I always tell my clients that while it may not be necessary now, using these vehicles for asset protection reasons remains incredibly valid, and it may be that at some point in the future, the estate planning becomes important again.
You know, Elizabeth, something I'd like to discuss, and this is something that just struck me, and it reminds me similar exemptions under George W. Bush, where they raised the estate tax exemption, but then it sunsetted. So even though we're at $11,180,000, it's my recollection that it sunsets around 2025. Is that true?
That's true. It does. Exactly. So it's possible that at sunset, we could go back to some prior exemption. And certainly, given our deficit, I've actually been predicting that for incorrectly. I mean, that's why I'm not a gambler, but I've been predicting that for a long time. And I've not been right today to this point, but it's always a possibility, especially if the deficit gets high enough. And certainly in this political climate, having a significant amount of wealth sheltered from an estate tax may actually become a political issue at some point in the future.
You know, let me ask you this. Right now, the exemption is $11,180,000. We know it's going to sunset, and history follows history. It's unlikely they're going to leave it at that level, given the political discord in the country currently. What about taking advantage of it now? Let's suppose that I'm Larry Lots of Bucks. I'm worth, $25 million, and I'm looking at this. I have a family business. I want to protect it, and I want to protect some of my assets. Could I take advantage of it now by putting $11,180,000 into an irrevocable trust to get it out of my estate? Would I be protected if later on they drop the exemption down to, let's say, $2 or $3 million?
That is a wonderful question. So currently, our estate tax system, transfer tax system, is a unified system. So the crazy part about this, which is probably why you've asked this question, is that at death, all of the assets that we own currently and the assets we've given away during our lifetime come back into our estate. The way that the Form 706, the estate tax return, is structured, you actually take all of the prior transfers and the assets at death, you apply a tax rate to come up with a tax, and then you apply, in essence, a credit. So even though currently now the value of the assets that's exempt is at $11,180,000, It's actually calculated on the return based on a credit. So if this were to change prior to death, it's possible that the amount that you have transferred into that irrevocable trust would still nonetheless be subject to estate tax. Now, that was really the constitutional question that we were looking at with the last sunset, this question, and I don't know if your listeners recall, but we had a year without estate tax that was kind of a transition year, because the question was, is it constitutional if at the time the transfer is made, if later we then yank those back into the estate? And the argument for it being unconstitutional is at the time you make the transfer, there is no tax and you can't have a retroactive tax. The flip side of it is that tax system is set up to be a unified system that all taxpayers understand applies at their death. So there's a good argument on either side. So to your point, I think if while it is an interesting thing to go ahead and do planning now, because I don't know the constitutional answer, but I certainly, from watching what happened in the past, believe that there's a lot of sentiment currently, at least to not allow a retroactive tax. So there would be some kind of additional credit given for transfers that have occurred prior to a change in the law. The problem is that we really don't know the answer to that. So using partnerships to discount value of assets, either at time of transfer or at time of death, and using the annual exclusion are ways to hedge against that risk. So if what we were doing was using, assets that we can reduce the value and use our annual exclusion, which is something that has stayed fairly consistent throughout our, kind of recent history, then that's a good way to hedge against this possibility in the future.
Yeah, because politically now you are seeing calls for, the inequality of wealth, where you have, individuals like Jeff Bezos, who's worth, God knows, $170 billion, and you have this enormous amount of wealth at the top, and you have disparities of inequality. So there's more and more calls that I'm starting to see with politicians that want to correct that in some way. So you do have to protect your assets, but also let's talk about protecting assets against creditors. Let's say that I am Larry Lots of Bucks again. I am worth a lot of money. I get into a car accident. Well, the first thing, the attorney representing the person that I got in an accident with is going to probably try to do an asset search and find out what I'm worth and what they can come after.
That's right. So again, I think it's interesting that we've now touched on the political climate, but that's exactly right. And, in my 30 years of practice, I have watched a huge shift in sentiment. So now, we've always, one of the beauties of our litigation or judicial system is that we were designed to allow full access to court, to judicial situation. So we allow contingent fees while most Western countries don't. The problem with that is that a contingent fee incentivizes litigation. So that's right. Those plaintiff's lawyers are looking for easy money. Most of them are financing the litigation because the plaintiff, that individual usually doesn't have the funds to do it. So what they're looking for is easy money. And unfortunately, in a lot of jurisdictions, the juries are very prejudiced against people who have lots of money because they themselves don't. So what our goal is from an asset protection standpoint is to create structures that take the cash off the balance sheet. And one of the things I'd like to point out, at the beginning of this particular discussion, is that in our country, we allow punitive damages in civil judgments, which is also atypical. Most Western jurisdictions don't do that. So let's say that you're Larry Lots of Bucks, and let's compare Larry Lots of Bucks to Betty No Bucks, right? So Larry, lots of bucks, has a big target on his chest because our system will allow the plaintiff to allege punitive damages against Larry. Betty, no bucks, because she has no assets. This kind of punitive damage claim, which would be based on value of assets that the defendant has, really has no value. So the problem that we have is that our court system will allow the damages to the plaintiff to be based on value of assets rather than on damage. Because if we assume that Larry Lotsabucks and Betty Nobucks had the exact same accident with the exact same liability and the exact same injury, unfortunately, our system will assess the damage award against Betty as much lower than the damage award against Larry Lotsabucks.
So let's talk about ways in which to protect that. There's something called a limited liability corporation. Explain the difference between an LLC, a subchapter S, or a C corp when it comes to liability.
Okay, fantastic. So let's review just for a second what a corporation is versus a trust versus a partnership, because it's important to understand those distinctions. So on the left, a trust is a relationship. It's just a group of parties who have a relationship with each other in which the legal and beneficial title are separated, so that the trustee has the legal title, the beneficiary has the beneficial title, and the settlor has trusted that trustee with the management and distribution of the assets. So that trust is can be formed with a written document, or it can be formed orally, but it really, it's a relationship, which means that it doesn't have a new, it doesn't spring into being as a new entity. It's a relationship among individuals. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, on the far right, is a corporation. A corporation is a brand new being. Think, Frankenstein, new being, where it has a legal personality, it has a place that it lives, it has everything about it is a separate person, separate from its creators and separate from its shareholders. So a corporation is vastly different from a trust, which is a relationship of individuals. An LLC is between the two. An LLC, like a limited partnership, was historically an aggregate ownership regime, which means that it was a group of individuals coming together to purchase or invest in assets that each of them had an undivided interest in. So very different from a trust or a corporation. So now let's talk about, that's kind of the historical difference. So historically, when we were looking at liability, with regard to the trust, there were, and we don't have time this morning to talk specifically about these trusts, but there's some public policy reasons why certain assets are protected in trusts and others are not. So there's very state-specific rules about what creditors can reach in this relationship called a trust. Now, with a corporation, the corporation has shares, and if we had a liability that's flowing up through the corporation, the corporate statutes would protect the shareholders from the claims of the business creditors, because that's what the statute's meant to do. But if there's a third party claim, let's say that Larry Lotsabucks, there's a judgment against him, then if he owned shares in a corporation, a court would order that those shares be turned over to the creditor as part of the satisfaction of the debt. So you've got a turnover order that could be applied to those shares. Now, again, in the middle is this limited partnership, limited liability company vehicle. The problem with it is that there was, while there were developing statutes as these things were evolving, because it evolved as this aggregate ownership regime, the question was, what if we have, we know that the entity will protect its owners from creditors underneath the structure, but what about third-party creditors? What, how are we going to handle that? Because we can't order a turnover of an interest in an aggregate ownership regime because let's say that, Jim, you and I are partners in a pig farm and I have an accident and there's a judgment against me. If my creditor is allowed to get my interest in that partnership, that means that that will, they're going to get, you know, part of each little piggy because you and I own those together. We can't segregate out the assets since we own them in an undivided way. So what the courts developed was this concept of a charging order that says that a creditor, in our, in my example, my creditor charges my interest in our pig farm with my liability. And when assets are distributed, income or principal, you know, the capital of the structure, it instead goes to my creditor until the liability is extinguished. So very different results depending on where the assets are held and what structure they're held in. Now, the interesting thing is that this aggregate ownership idea went away in the 80s, believe it or not. So we should have, starting in the 80s, courts should have been able to allow for turnover of interests in partnerships and limited liability companies. But because the statutes didn't adjust for the change in theory, we still have this different approach from a creditor standpoint, even though partnerships and LLCs are treated as entities instead of aggregate ownership regimes.
You know, Elizabeth, are there any kind of court cases or precedents where they've tried to pierce these asset protection entities, whether it's a LLC or a limited partnership? In other words, the legal system is always trying to find ways to get around laws or, let's say, change those laws in many ways through legal precedent. Has that happened before?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been a really wonderful and fun 30 years, maybe only 20 years, really watching the jockeying that's going on in this area. It's probably only me who loves this. I read an article about this in 98 on partnerships and then followed up with one on LLCs. And it's been very interesting to watch how the various state legislatures have adjusted their statutes. So the answer to your question is absolutely. Creditors have come after these structures and there's been a lot of activity. The result has been that states are firming up their statutes. Many states have, especially the asset protection states like Alaska, Delaware, Nevada, South Dakota, Texas. There's a lot of activity. Now, what's interesting is we got a case very recently that addressed this particular issue. And if I remember correctly, it's a case out of California. But the what the court said in that case, the case was a husband and wife who owned an interest in an LLC. And the question was, did the charging order protection of the state statute apply when there was no, quote, innocent party to protect, which is an interesting concept because none of the state statutes that I know of have addressed their statute to this innocent party idea, right? So the court ruled that because it was a husband and wife and there was no, quote, innocent party, that they would therefore not apply the charging order protection to the structure because there was no innocent party. So now what we're seeing, the new way to attack these structures is that there is no innocent party. So the way that one way to combat that is to make sure you have an innocent party. And so now we're full circle to estate planning. Because one thing you can do then is have trusts for children with a third party trustee as owners in these structures. Because, you know, even though they're children of the other owners, it would be hard, I think, to argue that they weren't innocent parties.
Let me bring up another issue, something that we saw take place in the last decade. George W. Bush raised the estate tax exemption, and then we had that 1 year, 2010, where there were no estate taxes. George Steinbrenner timed his death perfectly because he died in 2010. But then again, they changed it, and then once again, Trump changed it. And Elizabeth, we've seen over the last decade, where when I first got in the business, Reagan changed the estate tax exemption and the tax rates, and they were pretty stable for a long period of time. Recently, there seems to be this back and forth where one party comes in, they raise the exemption, they lower the tax rates, the next regime comes in, they lower the exemption and raise the tax rates. It's back and forth, and there's a lot more uncertainty today when it comes to planning. So it seems like, you know, estate planning is you can do things, but what you do may have to be changed based on how the laws change.
Absolutely. I mean, what you said, there's no truer words than what you've just spoken. There is no certainty. And if you look at it globally, it's even more interesting because there's a global movement toward raising taxes. Even on the transfer tax side in countries where there's been no transfer taxation. And there's a huge movement toward consolidating power and transparency and taxing at higher rates. So I think that the only thing we know is that it's going to remain uncertain. And my best advice to clients is whatever structures we put in place, they have to be nimble. You know, the old days of putting a trust in place that you thought should stay that way for the next 60 years are just gone. Whatever planning we put in place, we need to have an exit strategy and we need to be able to adjust. So for instance, practitioners really need to consider appointing a protector or an independent trustee who can amend a trust document to adjust for these changing tax rules. In the old days, we could kind of get to court and have the court reform the trust in a reasonable time frame. But, you know, given what's gone on in our court system and the way that the courts are so backed up, sometimes that can be really difficult. So what you've just said means it's so true. And what it means is that we really need to draft in flexibility to all of our documents, and we need to plan to be nimble because we honestly don't know. We have no idea. Anyone who says they can predict the future is just sadly mistaken. So that's the little bit I've learned in my 30 years of practice, and all I know is that the only way I can help clients is to draft flexibility into the documents and assume the worst, so that I plan for the worst and hope for the best, and don't get, it's really interesting, Jim, to look at law schools are starting to not teach complicated estate planning. Law firms are getting rid of their estate planning lawyers because there's this assumption that really there's such a small amount of the number in the population who needs this estate planning. But I think you've made an excellent point. And I think that, and I've been pretty vocal about that with law schools and law firms, that I think that they're making a big mistake, because we could very easily be in a situation where we're back to something in the $600,000 or $1 million range. If you focus on the fact that in England, what's called, their exemption is called a nil rate band, and it's about £360,000 that's tax-free in England, which is about $500,000. It's kind of beyond comprehension that people think that the U.S. wouldn't go back to something like that.
Elizabeth, are there any states to maybe set up legal entities that are better from an asset protection? You hear about Delaware, you hear about certain states like Nevada and others. Is there any that stand out to you? Because, you know, one thing that I think our listeners may not be aware of, even though currently the exemption is $11,180,000, so a husband and wife could shelter over $22 million, but there are, what, close to 16 states that have estate tax rates from 16 to 20% in Washington, or you have Maryland that has an estate tax and an inheritance tax. So I have seen this catch a lot of people by surprise. They thought they put their things in order and they were safe on the federal side to get whacked from estate taxes at the state level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that, you know, that's becoming a bigger and bigger issue. And with the change to our tax law that's limiting the deduction for those state taxes, it's become a bigger issue. The interesting thing is to watch, you know, just on a trust, from a trust standpoint, the, you know, movement toward using asset protection trusts that, you know, domestically, that's something that you and I've talked about before, and we don't really have time to talk about it today. But if we focus on it from a tax standpoint, either using the entity or, you know, a trust, it's, you know, again, you know, for instance, a lot of people are moving to states like Delaware or Texas that have no income tax with regard to those structures. The problem is that if you have a beneficiary, and I will speak to California because I've looked at this specifically, California will tax that trust if the beneficiary is located in California. So there is a lot of benefit to thinking it through from a state tax issue, making sure that you understand also that there's a big difference between citing an entity in a state that doesn't have tax, but then sourcing the income. So the income has to be sourced there in order to avoid the tax. But there is some possibility on a, from a trust or entity standpoint, to move the sourcing of income and assets to a different jurisdiction. But it has to be done very, very carefully, because that is becoming a much more important point, especially with the limitation on the deduction for the tax that's paid at a state level.
So as we look at the current environment, right now it's favorable, but we have no idea, nor can anybody predict what can happen in the future, because we do have one side calling for immediate tax hikes if they regain power. What does a wealthy individual do? Let's say, you know, you're fortunate enough, you have a very successful financial business or any kind of business that's worth a lot of money. You'd like to pass it on to your children, protect yourself not only from estate taxes, creditors, litigation. Is this something, it's kind of like, we know, Elizabeth, from a health perspective, we see our doctor once a year and we get a complete physical. Would you advocate doing the same thing with, let's say, your advisor and your attorney, saying, hey, you know, just coming in for a checkup, anything change? Is there anything on the horizon that could pose a risk to my estate?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, Jim, things are changing so quickly. I mean, just think about, all of a sudden, we have all of these issues coming out of this tax bill, right? We have the C-Corp issues don't apply to most of our individual clients, but we have 199A deduction, you know, can I create qualified business income? Does it apply for this deduction? What about the opportunity zone deduction? You know, should I, can I, you know, that deferral is so much easier than a 1031 deferral. So there are so, what's been interesting in my discussions with my clients' professionals, their investment professionals and their other lawyers and accountants, is this stuff is changing so quickly. The other thing that I would suggest is that they have, they consider having all of their professionals on the phone together. There's such an important synergy because the various professionals are looking at the changes in their particular area, And when you put everybody together, what comes out of that discussion is 110% better than what comes out of a discussion in some kind of siloed fashion. So absolutely. And it's almost like layers of an onion. Those meetings sometimes require follow-up meetings because an idea will pop out of that meeting and it needs to be addressed. And a lot of times our clients don't want to spend the money to have everybody involved. But I think that those kinds of meetings and discussions is just money very well spent.
So as we close, Elizabeth, what would you recommend? Let's say Betty no bucks, or your Larry lots of bucks, or somebody in between. Maybe get, for number one, you should have some kind of estate plan, whether it's a will, simple trust. You should be taking care of that so you don't run into problems if something happens, either death, conservatorships, probate, estate taxes, litigation, creditor protection, all the things we just discussed. What would you recommend?
In terms of what, who they're working with, or how to move forward?
Yes. In other words, let's say somebody listening to this program right now, they don't have an estate plan, number one, or number two, they have an estate plan, but it was put into effect, let's say, 10 years ago. This is something that I find with a lot of couples. They put an estate plan and it's kind of set and forget it. In the meantime, laws change, family situations have changed, economics have changed. Everything is in a constant change. We're getting older, you could have health issues. So what would you tell that couple?
First, I would say find a financial advisor and a lawyer that you like, right? Because you need to enjoy the time that you spend with them, because you need to spend a good bit of time with them. Don't let those things go by the by, because what you don't want to happen is your family has to deal with those issues after you die. The best gift you can give your family is a good estate plan. And, you know, in the same way that you take your car in to have the oil changed on a regular basis, you need to be checking in with your financial advisors and your lawyers. I mean, I recommend to my clients that we have quarterly calls. So quarterly calls, biannual meetings. And if we're talking to somebody who doesn't even have an estate plan, then they really need to get that straight away. They really need disability documents. They need to designate people who will take care of healthcare decisions, and they really need to focus on the opportunities to create not only wealth, but to create a situation where everyone in their family doesn't have to face the future with fear and anxiety, where they're comfortable that if the worst case happens, everything is in order. And even if they're not talking about having a taxable estate, the value of having life insurance in place to pay for a funeral, or a good estate plan, that means that it's going to be very easy for their assets to transfer at their death, or using revocable management trust to do that. That's the biggest and best gift they can give their family.
As we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about the work that you do, as you are considered an expert in your field and one of the top experts in the country, by the way, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, we're in the process of bringing our website back up. And my web designer tells me it will be there in a couple of weeks. But until then, the best way to get in touch with me would be by email at emorgan@emalegal.com.
And one more time?
emorgan@emalegal.com.
All right, Elizabeth, as always, it's a pleasure having you back on the program. I hope to talk to you again in the future.
Thanks so much, Jim. Have a wonderful weekend.
You do the same. Bye-bye. That concludes my interview with Elizabeth Morgan. A couple takeaways that I think you should come away with listening to that interview. Number one, the laws are constantly changing. What Congress giveth, they can taketh away. And we saw that clearly in the last decade, where under George W. Bush, the exemptions were raised, the tax rates were lowered. President Obama comes in and they lower the exemption and they raise the tax rates. President Trump comes in, raises the exemption, and eliminates state taxes, at least for the moment, for most Americans. What I can promise you, those tax laws will change again. And whether personally you have issues as you age, whether it's health, whether it's wealth, it's family issues, tax laws, there's always a reason, just like you want to see your doctor once a year, you want to see your advisor and your estate planner and make sure you're kept up to date, because I promise you, the laws will change again. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.